You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hello, and welcome to an author debriefing from the International Spy Museum. I'm Mark Stout, the museum's historian. Here at the museum, we get the most interesting authors, including journalists, scholars, former spies, and intelligence officers, coming in to speak with our visitors and answer questions about their latest works dealing with espionage, intelligence, and other national security issues. Please join me in listening to another of our selected hour-long author debriefings.
I'm Peter Ernest, the executive director of the museum, and I'm delighted to see all of you here this afternoon. It's a great turnout on really a very, very nice day. So welcome to the museum. I would ask you, out of kindness to the speaker, to please turn off your PDAs, cell phones, any other electronic gear you're working. Sometimes interferes with the system. I'm very pleased today to introduce Christina Shelton. She has written a book that I think is a fitting book in our time. It's a very straightforward account of a man by the name of Alger Hiss. And throughout my career in intelligence and in public life, a sort of secretive form of public life, the name Alger Hiss was a shibboleth. All you had to do was raise Alger Hiss at a dinner party, and you had a good chance, number one, of spoiling the dinner party, depending on who you were with, but at least raising arguments, loud and continuous. So I'm hoping that Christina Shelton's book will be one of those books that helps put an end to loud and raucous dinner parties. Christina Shelton's background was she worked for a number of think tanks and then was in the intelligence community for some 20 years. And she worked at both, primarily at DIA, but had details to CIA and the FBI and the Office of the Secretary of Defense, retiring in 2006. And this is her first book. So I'm pleased to say I was certainly very impressed with it, and I look forward to a very interesting interview. We're doing this in an unusual way today, and I think it'll be very interesting for you all. She will be interviewed by Dr. Mark Stout, who is our museum historian with his own background in intelligence. He has worked in the State Department's INR as well as in CIA. So you have two professionals discussing what has been one of America's most fascinating cases. So please help me welcome Christina Shelton and Mark Stout.
We all settled here? Yep. Okay. Mic should be on. Are you on?
Hello.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
All right. Well, let me also welcome you to the International Spy Museum. I think it's a terrific book with a great title as well, which we'll talk about here in a minute. But can you just start by saying, I mean, Peter was talking about how Hiss is sort of a shibboleth, I think, was the 25-cent word that he pulled out. Could you just give us a little background on who was this man, Alger Hiss?
Alger Hiss was a senior diplomat at the State Department during the 1940s, and he was exposed by Whitaker Chambers, Time magazine editor, as being a member of the Communist Party and involved in espionage. And at that time, he was a high-level official, so the case between the two men became headline news for several years. But going back a little, I would say that Alger Hiss came from a middle-class Baltimore family, and he spent his years growing up in school, especially at Johns Hopkins, Harvard Law School, and clerking for Chief Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. He spent that time networking and developing this persona of Upper Eastern establishment and a patrician of that group. And he finally became accepted by them as one of their own, and he became their fair-haired boy, even though he originally was not in that class. He spent the first few years of the Great Depression in the 30s as an attorney at very prestigious law firms in Boston and New York. And it was during this time that he started to become radicalized. And in 1933, he moved down to Washington, D.C. to work for FDR and the New Deal. In 1936, he got his first job at the State Department and spent 10 years there becoming a high-level official and FDR's representative at Yalta and a founder of the United Nations. The spying took place from 34 to sometime during the middle of World War II. And after the case in the 40s, when he was convicted of perjury related to espionage, the statute of limitations had run out on espionage, so he was convicted of perjury in a second trial. The first was a hung jury. And then he spent 44 months at Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary, and when he came out, he spent the next close to half a century. He died rather late in 1996 at 92 years old. He spent the entire time trying to vindicate himself. And he died claiming he was innocent.
So Hiss began spying in 34, you say. Yes. And he was spying, as I understand it, for the GRU, which was Soviet military intelligence, not the NKVD, the predecessor to the KGB.
The GRU, Soviet military intelligence, had recruited him when he moved to Washington, D.C. He joined the Wehr Group in 1934. That was an underground cell that worked for Soviet military intelligence. And Whitaker Chambers was the person who was running that cell. And Donald Hiss, his brother, and Alger were two of several people in that group.
Well, just very briefly before we move on, why did the Soviet military intelligence recruit a diplomat? You would think that they'd be focusing more on, you know, military personnel or people who worked in defense industry. Why was he run by the GRU instead of by the predecessor to the KGB, or do we know?
Yes, at that time in the 30s, actually the GRU was the premier agency in the Soviet Union for foreign intelligence. The KGB was not as advanced as they were. They had more networks, they were more developed, and they needed to have a lot of State Department type classified information to find out, you know, what the plans were for the U.S. during World War II that they saw on the horizon, you know, what Hitler's plans were, what our plans were. So they wanted to have that information, as well as they were the front premier spying agency at that time.
So the subtitle of your book is Why He Chose Treason. Why did he choose treason? Let's just get right to it.
During the Depression, the economic chaos that took place, millions losing their jobs and banks foreclosing, thousands of people embraced communism during that time in this country. They thought that capitalism was dying and that the United States was doomed politically and economically, and they looked towards socialism and Moscow as the avenue to save this country. Some of them went beyond that, like Alger Hiss, and spied for Moscow. And for them, like people like Hiss, they were committed, totally committed communists. They believed in it. They believed it was a utopia, despite the fact that Stalin was killing millions of people. They saw only utopia, Hiss did. And to him, from his perspective, he was not committing treason against the United States, but going to an ideology that would save the United States. That was his perspective.
So you're not saying he did this out of patriotic motives, are you?
No. Okay. Well, no. He was looking at it from an international perspective. He believed in world peace, international collaboration, social justice, equality. He saw only utopia. He had a blind spot toward the crimes going on in the Soviet Union.
I forget who said it, but one participant in the Cold War famously noted, as I recall, that the communists had all the good words, like peace and equality. They were really good at deploying those words.
Right.
Would it be fair to say, though, also, perhaps a little bit in Hiss's defense, that in the 20s and the 30s, we didn't know a whole lot about the crimes going on in the Soviet Union and what a thoroughly horrible guy Stalin was? I mean, there was certainly reason to ask that question, but it's not like we understood the horribleness of the Soviet Union and of Stalin, say, the way we did after Khrushchev's secret speech.
That's
or in subsequent decades.
Right, that's correct, especially in the 30s. But as you went into the 40s and after World War II, it became apparent the crimes, especially Stalin's campaign to starve all the thousands of peasants in the Ukraine. All of this became known to the West, for those who would acknowledge it. And that's why you had a lot of communists breaking away. Whitaker Chambers broke from the party in 1938 after seeing the evils of Stalin and the Nazi Soviet Pact. That particular event caused a lot of them to break with the party.
Now, Hiss spied for the Soviets, and you talked a good bit about that in your book. Do you also think he was an agent of influence for the Soviets, somebody working inside the U.S. government to see that we implemented pro-Soviet policies, or was he just quietly and secretly spying and doing nothing else? What's your take on that?
Well, my take is the same take as a former communist. Louis Boudens was the head of the Daily Worker from 1940 to 45, and then he broke with the party. And his position was that the communist conspiracy in the United States was done by two particular types of people, those stealing information, spies, and agents of influence. And he suggested that sometimes a select comrade would do both. Well, Hiss was such a select comrade, because he was in a position at the State Department to have access to classified material, and which he stole and gave to Whitaker Chambers, who in turn passed it to the GRU, Soviet Military Intelligence. But as important, he was in a position to influence policy that could benefit the Soviet Union and Moscow's goals. He was in a position to influence policy from that post at the State Department, and when he was a representative at Yalta, which he did.
Tell me a little bit more about what we know about what he was doing at Yalta. Maybe back up just for a minute and give a couple sentences on the importance of Yalta, and then explain perhaps what he was doing at Yalta, why you come to the conclusion you do about his role in Yalta.
Well, I thought Yalta, to me, was the most important chapter of the book, because I wanted to take this more strategic view of the Hiss case, not just look at the contents between Chambers and Hiss. And Hiss was selected by FDR to go to Yalta, even though at that time he was a mid-level official. He wasn't a high-level official. But he was selected to go. And papers from Secretary of State Stantonius, now available at the University of Virginia, showed that he depended and relied heavily on Hiss for policy background and information. And he was informed, Hiss was informed on every substantive issue discussed at Yalta, not just what his responsibility was, the founding of the UN, but on borders of Poland, German reparations, Indochina, the Chinese Mao Zedong Chiang Kai-shek war. He was informed on all issues, and Secretary Stantonius, right before they all left to go to Yalta, told his staff that every paper for Roosevelt and all the black books being prepared for Yalta were to be in Hiss's hands 2 weeks before they left. So he had access to everything, all the substantive issues, what the United States was willing to do, willing to negotiate, what our position was. The bottom line is, most books previously have talked about Hiss's role at Yalta as not very important. He was a note taker. Well, the information suggests otherwise. Most importantly, the foreign relations of the United States, the official document on various, well, a whole history of foreign policy, the book on Yalta, it's about 1,000 pages, I think, you have to know what page to go to find out the minutes of meetings where Hiss was involved. They're not located, all of them, in the index, because, and this is from a book inside the State Department by Brighton Barron. He said there was an effort within state to downplay Hiss's role so that you have to go through this entire volume to find out all the meetings he was attending.
It wasn't readily indexed to make apparent the importance of Hiss's role.
Exactly.
One of the most engaging parts of your book, I thought, was where you talked about how you met Hiss once, and I had the pleasure of hearing you recount this in person in your own voice at lunch yesterday, and I think the audience would be interested to hear about your personal brush with Alger Hiss.
Well, it was sort of a fluke. I received a call one day in 1979 from a friend saying, how would you like to meet Alger Hiss? I said, what are you talking about? Well, apparently every year a group of left-wing intellectuals in New York City, I was in Washington, D.C. at the time.
And you may have been an intellectual, but not left-wing.
Right. They provided a celebration in his honor at his birthday time. And it was the same group every year. And apparently Hiss told one of his hosts that he wanted some diversion. These parties were getting boring. So that word filtered down to somewhere along the line where this friend of mine heard it and called me. And I said, sure, I'll go. So I took the shuttle up the day of the party. And when I arrived at the apartment, I was the first one there. And Hiss walked in like 5 minutes later. And he came into the living room, and we had about 15 minutes before the guests started arriving. And it was fascinating because I was asking him about Whitaker Chambers' book, The Witness, and he said he had never read it. And I kind of reacted like, what do you mean? How is that possible? How could you say you never read this book? It was very popular, very famous, and it was about, you know, the New Deal, not just about his contest with Alger Hiss. And so he didn't say much to me. And after I stopped venting, the guests started to arrive, and I got up to walk out. And he said, no, I want you to stay. And as every guest came up to him, and I must say they were really fawning over him. It was like they were meeting the Pope. They said, I want to introduce you to Mrs. Shelton. That's all he said, because that's all he knew was my name. And they all gave me this kind of quizzical look like, who the hell is she? They knew I was an outsider and not part of that intellectual group in New York. But when I left, you know, he came and saw me to the door. He got my coat. He said, I want you to meet my son, Tony. And he introduced me to Tony. And then I was out of there. And a couple of days later, I heard that he had, you know, he thought it was great. He was very impressed. I don't know why. I still don't know why, but when I was researching this book, I read Tony Hiss's book on Alger Hiss's experience in prison for 44 months, and this was just a few years ago. I'm reading the book in preparation for this, and I'm sitting there, and it said, you know, in 1953 or 54, I forget which, when my father was in prison, he had access to the library, and Saturday Evening Post published Witness in 10 installments, and he read the whole thing and talked about his views on it. So I guess, why did he lie to me? I guess he just didn't want to get involved in discussing Witness. It was easier to say than read it.
You've mentioned, speaking of Witness, you've mentioned Whitaker Chambers several times. Can you tell us a little bit about who he was, and in what ways perhaps was he different from Alger Hiss?
Well, everybody knows the image of Whitaker Chambers, short, frumpy, rumpled, fat, and he was standing next to this good-looking, handsome, intellectual, Ivy League, Harvard graduate, and they immediately drew their impression, who was innocent and guilty, just by looking at them. But as a matter of fact, Witness Chambers was a brilliant mind, he was very smart, his teachers and the faculty at Columbia University was there for 2 years, was so impressed with his intelligence and his writing ability too. He was a great writer. But he had this image that was not the same as his. Whittaker Chambers was born in 1901. He died early in 61. He grew up in Long Island. He went to Columbia for a couple of years. But when one summer he went to Europe on a student trip, and the economic chaos and moral corruption and the disruption and everything from post-World War I Europe affected him to such a degree that when he went back, he dropped out of Columbia and he joined the party in 1925. He was one of those people who didn't join as a result of the Depression in the 30s. He joined in the 20s. And he immediately became a journalist. He wrote for the Daily Worker and the New Masses, the two communist publications. So he was in the Open Party. At the time, the Communist Party did not want anyone being in the Open Party and doing underground work. It was very compartmentalized. So when they decided that he should run this underground cell in Washington, D.C., that Hiss was part of, he had to quit his job as a journalist and go underground. And then when he finally had this debate with Al J. Hiss over the spying, when they had to, you want me to get into the congressional hearings?
Go for it. That's the big dramatic moment.
Right. The congressional hearings were taking place, and
so this would have been roughly when then?
It was in the 40s. They were investigating communist penetration into the U.S. government, and Whittaker Chambers' name kept surfacing when they were testifying, various people were testifying. So finally, they called Chambers, and this was a famous moment, August 1948. He acknowledged he was a communist. He acknowledged he ran an underground cell, and he said one of the members was Al J. Hiss, and it was like dropping a nuclear bomb, because Hiss at this time was the fair-haired boy. His sponsors were people like Eleanor Roosevelt and Felix Frankfurter and Dean Acheson. They were all his people. And so that turned into a contest between the two of them that went from the congressional hearings to a libel case to a case before a jury. And Hiss kept saying he didn't know Chambers by that name, which was true. He knew Whittaker Chambers by his underground cover name, which was Carl. But finally, Whittaker Chambers had so much detail about Al J. Hiss as a result of them working closely together that it became apparent they were close and he knew him well and that Hiss wasn't telling the truth. And of course, he finally was convicted. And then Chambers, for the next 10 years from 38 to 48, while Hiss was working his way up in the State Department, Whittaker Chambers was working himself up in Time magazine, working for Henry Luce, and he became a senior editor of the magazine. That's what he was in 48.
It's always seemed to me that, and you touched on this briefly, but maybe if I could get you to expand a little bit, that there's almost a bit of a class component to this clash, this comparison between Hiss and Chambers, even though they actually came from, you know, roughly comparable social backgrounds originally, that they probably appeared quite differently, and just want to talk about that a little bit. I know Hiss is somebody, and I forget if this was in your book or in Susan Jacoby's book, but who liked to make a great deal out of, you know, that he'd been to Harvard. I think he once made some snarky comment to Richard Nixon about, I'm a Harvard man, what was your school? Oh, yes, right. You're, you know, Whittier.
Yeah. He's ever very arrogant about a background that he developed and pursued, not that he came from. He developed this persona. The class difference was not really, as you say, accurate, because both came from a middle-class family. However, Aldrich wound up in the class of the Upper Eastern establishment. Chambers was claiming, as people he knows, a prostitute from New Orleans called One Eye Annie. He didn't have any people on his team. However, that was in the 40s. But in 1952, after he wrote Witness, and as a conservative movement was emerging as a result of William F. Buckley starting National Review, he became, you know, the hero for the conservative movement, and they all supported him. But before that, it was the people who supported his that made you think it was there was a class distinction. As I said before, two Supreme Court justices, a First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt. He had support of the major media types, Walter Lippmann, Joe Alsop.
All the big names at the time.
The big names, yeah.
And this is also a time, I think, where, you know, journalists were still, journalism was not a high-class profession in public perception. I mean, the public perception was that journalists were fairly sleazy individuals who hung around at the bars near the train station. With that, I think probably perhaps Whitaker Chambers may have suffered a little bit in the public perception from that.
Exactly, yeah.
Alger Hiss had some interesting comments later in life about communism and how it would be to live under a communist regime. Can you tell us a little bit about his thoughts on that, his thoughts on like whether or not he'd want to live in the Soviet Union, for instance?
Yes, I was very fortunate while I was writing this that Tony Hiss turned over all of his father's personal correspondence and papers, everything, over to the archives at NYU, the Tamminit Library. And none of that had been mined in the previous book on Hiss, so I was like there first. And I sat there for hours reading all these personal letters from Hiss to his wife, his son, in the 30s when he was in prison. I also found this wonderful document that he was given an interview with at Columbia University in 1975, much later. It was over a 200-page document. And he was discussing all sorts of political issues. But that at the very end, they asked him, you know, what was his take on communism? And he's talking about this in 1975. And it was some intriguing comments he made. He said, well, for myself, I would not want to live in a communist system because of the lack of freedoms to travel, write, think, read whatever you want. And he acknowledged this. Of course, you know, he's not a communist, right? So he's saying this. But then he said, for the people who were in the system, he thought it improved their lives. It mitigated the hardships that they had. And he specifically mentioned Russia, China, Cuba, that their life was much better than it had been under the Tsars in previous times. So the people who were trapped in it, he thought that was great for them, but it wasn't good for him. He also made an interesting point that, you know, he was talking about how many people were killed. He denied that it was millions. He thinks the numbers weren't that many. A lot of people left China, so it probably wasn't that many. He tried to justify it by numbers. And then he said, you know, well, the means justifies the ends. He said that in a different way, but that's what he was saying. That the important way to look at a revolution is not necessarily about looking at what's happening at the time to the people, but what its ultimate goals are. So this was fascinating stuff because no one ever was able to get into his head to find that stuff out, and this was in his own words.
Yeah, he seems to have been a man who sort of held his own views and his own opinions and his own emotions pretty closely. Right. My understanding is his autobiography, which I'll admit I have not read, but I'm told is fairly unforthcoming about his inner life.
Right. Well, he has a few things in there, too, but it is fairly, it's pretty straightforward. He doesn't discuss his thoughts or ideas that much.
Just a couple more questions, and then we'll go to the audience, because I'm sure there's a lot of folks out there who want to get in on this. But you started out your introduction in the book by asking, why do we need another book about Hiss? So, and he has been extensively written about. So what's your answer to that? Why do we need this book? Why did you write this book?
Well, I wrote the book because I've always been interested in the subject, counterintelligence, espionage, and of course, this is one of the most famous cases, if not the most, after the Rosenbergs. And it's just a fascinating saga because you're dealing with two men who were on opposing sides with different worldviews, interesting people, brilliant people. The story is fascinating just in and by itself. Then I started thinking, you know, most of the books on Hiss, there have been a lot written. Do I want to write a book? Most of them focus on the case. Who is telling the truth during the trials and during the congressional hearings? I thought it was much more than that. I saw it as a very strategic view and perspective. What mattered was ideology. That's what his was about. That's what drove his thinking. That's what drove his behavior. These two opposing worldviews between collectivism and individualism are so clearly seen in the struggle between these two men. This is almost a titanic struggle between the two. So I thought it was important to put the story in the context of ideology. I also thought it was important to tell more about his significant role in foreign policy, especially at Yalta and the founding of the UN. And as I said just now, having the his personal papers from the NYU archives, which showed a very humanistic style, side of his sweetness almost, as Whitaker Chambers acknowledged. He was a very sweet man. His concern and love for his wife, and especially Tony, his son, all of this comes through in his correspondence. You see this very human side of the man, which didn't necessarily come through in other books. And finally, most importantly, the KGB archives and Hungarian archives were available to pretty much put the nail, final nail in the coffin. I mean, especially the KGB archives, where Hiss is cited not only by his crypt and cover name, but in clear text, Alger Hiss, in the archives. And this material is all online. You can get it. Distilyev was the Russian who brought it out and gave it to the Smithsonian and for free. And it's all online. It's fascinating material.
Yeah, I think it's online with the Cold War International History Project, if I recall
exactly.
correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So last question from me before we go to the audience then, and this sort of ties together what you've been saying with what Peter's been saying. Why is the question of Hiss's guilt or innocence been for so many decades now, finally fading, I think, but for so many decades, why was it a litmus test of Americans' political views? Why did this seize our imagination, and why do we care in such a, as a society in such a visceral way about Alger Hiss? It's not like he was the only person who spied for the Soviets, and it's not like he was the only spy for the Soviets who denied that he'd done it. So why did this catch on?
He was a major figure, and he was one of the few who denied it to his deathbed. But it was because they represented such clear, distinct worldviews. And to the left, he was an icon. He was a symbol. They were more concerned about his collectivist views than the fact that he committed treason. That wasn't their concern. They would never throw a dart. They would never go against his, because to them it was like a shadow over the New Deal and FDR and Yalta. So Hiss got their support. That was even, his defense. Not supporting me is throwing a dark cast on all these other things that were important in history. And he became a symbol for the left. And these two camps, opposing camps, was no middle ground, formed in the 40s and has continued to this day, although his supporters have decreased immensely, especially as the KGB archives showed that he was in fact a spy. There were very few people left. But even in the 50s, a lot of people began to disown him. Moynihan did, Schlesinger did, a lot of people on the left, I mean. I.F. Stone, there's quite a few of them that decided he wasn't telling the truth, he was a spy. And the people on the right, for the same reason, thought Chambers represented the truth and a conservative view of life, and were opposed to collectivism and socialism. So it set up what's going on today in the United States, as a matter of fact. We're going through the same thing as a result of the economic crisis today that they went through in the 1930s. You have people thinking that the government should be more involved, should do more, and you have people who say it comes at the cost of individual freedom and liberty. Where do you draw the line? And in this country for 200 years, we pretty much were able to draw a line between these two opposing views. But during the Depression and today, because of the economic downturn, it's more difficult. People are beginning, the national dialogue today, what it was in the 30s, they're questioning what is the legitimate extent of the power of the federal government.
Okay, well, I'm sure we've got several questions here. If you'll wait for the microphone to get to you because we're recording this, we'll start with the gentleman in the middle there.
Wonderful presentation. You've not mentioned Richard Nixon and the Woodstock, because people who disliked Nixon thought that not only was it Whitaker Chambers, but Nixon was the adversary, and Nixon, without the Hiss case, would never have been tapped as vice president, so it launched his career. And I never understood why the Woodstock typewriter wasn't discarded, because if the government got a hold of it, then it was really a smoking gun.
Well, the reason why I didn't focus on Nixon is I didn't want to get involved in the politics of the 50s, McCarthyism and Nixon. I was talking about the ideological aspects, which puts Chambers up front in the picture. Of course, I don't know if everyone knows, Richard Nixon was the junior congressman from California on this congressional committee, and he was the one convinced that Hiss was lying about knowing Chambers, so he was the one pushing the case forward. And as a result of that, the left became very anti-Nixon, and eventually they did win that battle.
Well, Nixon helped a little.
Yeah, right. Well, no, but they went after him seriously, because I think they had this feeling of what he did to Hiss. They always kept that feeling about what he did to Hiss. And McCarthy, too, with the witch hunts in the 30s and 40s. I thought Christopher Hitchens made a wonderful statement. I put it in my book. He said, if Hiss was wrong, then Nixon and McCarthy were right, and that could not be. So that kind of sums it up.
Any thoughts on, just quickly, on the Woodstock typewriter? I don't want to get too far down into the rat hole of this case, but any thoughts on the Woodstock?
When you hear... I'm not talking about pumpkin papers and typewriters here. I know those are the typical symbols of the story. But the thing about the typewriter was there were all kinds of contentions, whether it was the original one or the FBI putting the phony one, this and that. But as Murphy, who was the prosecutor, said, you know, the point is that the papers that were typed from the classified material had the same font as the papers that Priscilla Hiss used in her papers. So it could have been any typewriter. The font was the same of her personal typewritten material and the State Department classified material that was typed.
Peter, I think, is going to...
Yeah, you had a chance to review the papers that Tony had contributed, and I'm just wondering, is there any suggestion in there that Hiss dropped his guard either with his first wife, Priscilla, or that any of them said anything that he revealed more than
what do you
he
think
wanted
I was
the public
looking
to know?
For? What do you think I was looking for?
And I'm just wondering if you found anything.
I found two things. One is the files, you know, the folders go from 19, maybe 29 to 30. They married in 29. And each folder is by year. There's a missing folder. And it was the 2 years he was associated with Whitaker Chambers. Now, apparently this inveterate letter writer didn't write any letters for 2 years while he was in Whitaker Chambers' network. The other thing I found was about Priscilla Hiss, his first wife. She had denied during the trials that she was a socialist, a member of the Socialist Party, I should say. And they brought up all, you know, they had this information saying we have, we have the, what do you call it? When the catalog showing members, her name was there. She denied it. She, you know, kept denying it all the way through. There was a letter written to her husband in March when she was in New York and he was working for a law firm in Boston for 1 year. He would commute to New York. And she was living near Columbia University with her brother and sister-in-law. And she and her brother were members of the Socialist Party up in Morningside Heights, that chapter. And she was writing about how her chapter of the party was doing this and this and this. This is her handwriting, her letter, which absolutely flat out said her party, the chapter she belonged to.
With the lady here on the aisle. Wait, hold on, wait for the mic. We're recording this.
Given that Chambers and Hiss were more or less equivalent to the commitment to communism, can you speculate on what caused Chambers to break with it on the basis of evidence, mm-hmm. and Hiss, so kind of an equally intelligent, astute person, to continue to have a blind spot? And I just have one comment. You keep on talking about communism and socialism as if they're the same thing, and there are like vast differences between the two. So that's just a comment.
Well, I think most of the time I'm talking about communism. Until the very end, I use the word socialism in connection with a collectivist worldview in terms of today. But Chambers and Hiss both were committed communists, totally committed. Hiss never deviated. Chambers went to see Hiss and told him why he was breaking with the party and gave him all the crimes of Stalin murdering millions of people, the Bolsheviks who made the revolution, starving the peasants in the Ukraine, the Nazi-Soviet pact. He went on and on and on how they turned their back on the German communists, how they turned their back on the Spanish Republican group. And he said that Stalin's behavior, he behaved as a true communist, which showed the evilness of that system. So, I mean, a lot of people broke from the party because of these very things, but Hiss was one that just had a blind spot. As I said, he saw only utopia.
All the way in the back, Nick Reynolds.
And then we have someone up here who's been very patient.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, you can be next.
I've got a double-barreled question about sources. I'm very interested to hear about Vasiliev's papers in the Library of Congress. Has anyone been able to go back further than his handwritten notes? I mean, what would happen if you wrote a letter to the SVR archivist and said, say, are you going to do a FOIA anytime soon? And maybe the answer to the question, I wonder, is you mentioned the Hungarian archives. I'd be intrigued to hear more about that.
I don't know if anyone's going to pursue that more. This woman, Maria Schmidt, who is a Hungarian archivist, happened to come across the original interrogation files of Noel Field when he was arrested by the Hungarians. And in that, this was in the 40s. Stalin had him arrested. He was using him as an excuse to purge East European leaders, and he claimed he was an American spy, which of course he wasn't. He was a communist. And Noel Fields admitted in this interrogation, which was taking place in the early 50s, he said that during the 1930s, when he was in the U.S., he was at a dinner party, and Alger Hiss tried to recruit him for the GRU. And he told him, which was very bad tradecraft, you know, well, I'm already a member of a KGB network. Don't bother. So he was a member of the network run by Hedy Massing. And this is an interesting point, because Hedy Massing corroborated this story that was found in the Hungarian archives. Whitaker Chambers corroborated the story because Hiss told him, and it was in KGB archives. So you have all these different sources from different people confirming that Hiss tried to recruit Noel Field into the GRU in 1935, I think it was.
Gentleman over here.
If I could ask you to speculate about Hiss's thinking, do you think that at some point that he convinced himself that he hadn't done it? Or do you think that he got up every day for the last 50 years of his life saying, I'm going to lie again today? I've dealt with both kinds of people, and I'm curious as to what you think he was thinking.
Now, there's an interesting question.
Well, I think
why he was on this campaign to vindicate himself?
Whether he sincerely believed after a time that he had not spied, whether he convinced himself of his own
lies. I'm sure that's pure speculation. I think he was a rare person committed to the very end that he was doing the right thing in terms of his perspective on the political life in this country.
Hang on. Wait. Try that again.
Perhaps I'm not being clear. Did he believe that I was never a communist? I never spied. The only way I knew Chambers was as this dead
man. No, I think he knew Chambers. He knew he was a communist. But the word spying to him, once again, the blind spot, to him it was supporting a system. It wasn't treason against a system. It was doing it to support a system he believed in.
So you think then, if I just to clarify this, you don't think that he reimagined the facts of history? Like, you don't think that he wiped from his mind the fact that he had passed information, but rather he just simply morally sort of believed the positive value of that as opposed to the negative?
Exactly.
So it was not about facts, it was about the interpretation of the facts.
Exactly.
You think
it was his perspective.
Mm-hmm. The lady right here in the second row?
Yes, if I understand the flyer, the handout said, finally, Hiss was convicted only of perjury. Well, does that mean then there was another trial, and I assumed he died of natural causes then in prison, but the Rosenbergs were executed, so what was different in Hiss' trial?
Now, he was given a prison term. The statute of limitations had run out on espionage when he was convicted. So he was given a term of 5-year sentence
for
perjury, because he lied about giving material to Hiss. And of course it was related to the espionage, but it was about perjury. So he was convicted for that. But because of good behavior, he got off in 44 months. But he lived until 1996, 92 years old. He spent almost half a century saying he was innocent. He died of natural causes in New York at 90.
So espionage, the federal government couldn't pursue the espionage question with him?
No.
Yeah, just any quick comment on sort of the distinction between Rosenberg and the Rosenbergs rather and Hiss? That's the other big case in, you know, espionage case from that general period in American culture.
Well, the Rosenbergs were ordinary people. They weren't part of the elite like Hiss was. He had high powered support. I mean, Dean Acheson, Eleanor Roosevelt. The Rosenbergs were your run of the mill communists. However, they were involved in passing information on the Manhattan Project. And I think that's what made it more, you know, a lot of people say, well, what did Hiss do? So what? He influenced policy. To them, it wasn't as bad, to many people. But also, the thing about the Rosenbergs, the distraction there is everybody realized he was guilty. It was his wife. That became the problem. She was unfairly executed. So that's a different twist on that story. I mean, she might have been involved to some extent. It's not clear. But I think, I'm not an expert on this, but I think that it was the judge or maybe the prosecutor who were trying to get them to confess that they claimed they were going to execute them both. They were using that, I believe. I don't know if someone shed light on that.
Okay. Just briefly.
Ethel was put out as bait in the hope that he would confess.
Right.
He never did, and therefore she essentially was executed for his recalcitrance to confess.
Right.
The gentleman two rows behind there. I think it's one row behind. Yes, I'm sorry. I miscounted.
Yeah, thanks. Hi, Christina. Really terrific presentation. I don't know as much as I would like to about what Elger Hiss's job was in the spring of 1945 at San Francisco when the UN Charter was being crafted. So I wonder if you could tell me about that. And specifically, has there ever been some suggestion that there he was, in fact, spying for the Soviets and trying to, I don't know, somehow craft the UN Charter to our detriment and their benefit?
The UN issue came up during Yalta, and this was an interesting sidebar to the whole Yalta story, because Hiss was in favor of everything that was coinciding with the Soviet position, with the exception of the UN. Stalin wanted 15 seats at the UN, one for each republic, even though they weren't sovereign countries. The US position was, especially Roosevelt and Hiss, no, you get one seat. And then they went from 16 down to 3. And then they agreed that they would only take 2 extra seats, Belarus and Ukraine. So they wound up with a total of 3. But Hiss was in the forefront of opposing this. And my speculation on that, because it's an anomaly, it's different from everything else, was that Stalin was getting everything he wanted at Yalta, most importantly the Polish borders and total control of all Eastern Europe and territory in Asia. He was getting everything he wanted. Some hypothetical organization that was not even founded yet, whether he got 2 or 3 seats, I think that was a distraction. So it wasn't that important. And that's why Hiss made it seem as though, no, you only get one seat. I think controlling Eastern Europe was more important than whether you got 1 or 3 seats.
Other questions? Right up here in the front row. Sorry to make you run, Laura. The lady right here.
Hello. You mentioned Tony as a son.
Yes.
Did Hiss have other children?
No, he had a stepson. When he married Priscilla, his first wife, they were very devoted for 30 years. They became radicalized together. She had been married before to a guy named Hobson, and they had a son, Timothy, who's, by the way, alive today in his 80s in California. He's a retired doctor. And, of course, he's always been pro-Hiss. Then when she married Alger, they had one son much later in 1941, Tony Hiss. It was their only child. He's still alive. He lives in Greenwich Village. He's about 70 years old now. He went to Harvard. He was a writer for New York Magazine. He wrote for one of the sections. I can't remember.
Around the Town or some name,
yeah,
like that. I don't remember.
Talk of the Town. He was a writer for that. And he lives, when Alger and Priscilla left Washington and moved back to New York, he was going to work for the Carnegie Institute after he left State Department. They rented this small apartment in the village. And then the family still lived there when he was in prison, when he got out of prison, after he and Priscilla split up because she wanted to run away and have new names and start a new life. And he said, no, I'm going to vindicate my name. So they broke up. And she didn't want to divorce him. She wouldn't. So he was living with another woman called Isabel for years and years and years, and they finally married when Priscilla died. Tony still lives in the same apartment with his wife and son that they moved into in 1946.
I got to say, I don't have a lot of sympathy for Alger Hiss, but I do have a great deal of sympathy for Tony. That's got to be a difficult situation growing up as the son of somebody like Alger Hiss.
Yeah, he had an interesting comment in his book. He said that Alger Hiss had 3 faces. The first face was this lovely, warm human being, affectionate person that he knew as a father. And this was the same face that you see in the letters and that Whittaker Chamber talked about. And then he said, the second face of my father was this very neutral kind of removed, loyally position, you know. And he said, the third face, I don't agree with. That's the dark side, and that's what Whittaker Chambers sees, the face of the spy. So that's how he characterized it.
I think we've got maybe 2 more questions. The gentleman here, and then after that, the lady on the aisle.
Hi. What was your take on the wives? Were they sympathetic to the Communist Party movement, or sometimes that gets discussed in literature, sometimes
the
not.
Two wives?
Yes.
Yeah, Priscilla was, in fact, according to Whitaker Chambers, she was more of a committed communist than her husband. It's not clear who exactly recruited Hiss or if he recruited himself. You can't find any evidence to show Priscilla was the one who recruited, but they kind of in tandem became radicalized during the 30s. She was a committed socialist. Isabel, he doesn't talk about much. She was a beautiful woman, a model. She worked for various health magazines. The only connection in her biography is with the left is that she was married previously to one of the producers in Hollywood that were on the 10, the Black 10, you know, whatever that list was.
The Hollywood Blacklist.
The Hollywood 10. One of those was her husband.
All right, last question right here.
Further to this gentleman's question, I was going to ask whether there, did the government have evidence that Priscilla helped him do it? Did they just steer clear of her? Do you know whether she helped type with classified papers and so forth?
Well, that was the charge, since he had to type the papers. He would bring them home at night, and either Whitaker Chambers would run them to Baltimore and have his person copy them, or she would type them in her home. He didn't type, I believe. I don't think Alger has typed. It's her typewriter. She did the typing. But she claimed, you know, all of this was not true. She wasn't involved. She didn't type anything. But there was no way to prove who sat at the table at night and typed classified material.
So she was, therefore, there was just not even the beginnings of a perjury case against her. Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, let's thank Christina Shelton for a fascinating talk.
I hope you enjoyed this author debriefing. We'd like to know if you have any questions or comments about it. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. We look forward to you joining us again for another of our author debriefings, and thanks for listening.